My name is Jimmy James Jaramillo, also known as Harold Miller in the Navy. In the Navy, I got that name. They couldn't pronounce Jaramillo, so they said Harold Miller, and that's what stuck. My age is 76. Today's March 11th, 2020, and we're here in Las Cruces, America. The name of my partner that we're going to be visiting with you on is Jesse Addison, and he's like a brother to me, so we'll be visiting with you. Jesse, take it away.
Okay, my name is Jesse Addison. My age is 73. Today is March the 11th, 2020. The location is Las Cruces, New Mexico. And Jimmy Jaramillo is my best friend, and we spend a lot of time together.
Okay. I was about to get drafted, and the American Legion had the naval recruiter next door, and I had been in New Mexico State University's Army program, and I thought, I don't think I want to go Army. So I did go and sign up for the Navy. I put in 4 years, and I caught everybody in the family by surprise because they figured I'm going to be around for a while. My sister had just gotten married May 1st and May 20th. I joined the Navy.
Well, I had a school deferment. I was going to an automotive school and welding. And I decided that I would do that for a living and not go to Vietnam. Well, 24 hours after I graduated, I came home and my mother and father were sitting on the couch in the living room, and nobody ever sat on the couch in the living room. So I knew it was something wrong. And I said, I was trying to think, what did I do? What did I do? Some of my friends must have snitched on me. But my father handed me the letter and said, "Greetings, this is your Uncle Sam." And I went, oh my God, I can't leave. I just bought a new car and new clothes. So my father said, yeah, we went. He was a World War II veteran in the Navy. And all my family members most of them were in the Navy. So he said, it's your turn. You need to go. So I said, that's fine. So I went down I was from Chicago. So I went down to the recruiting station. I walked in, and I was standing in line. I happened to see a lot of friends of mine in the back. And I kind of stuck my head out, and I was talking to this guy way in the back of the line. And all of a sudden, somebody walked up and poked me from behind. And I said, who are you? He said, oh, you want to know who I am? It was a Marine Corps gunnery sergeant. He said, Marine Corps, step in that room right here. So I got back home, and I told my father. I said, I think I'm in the Marine Corps. He goes, no, you're going in the Navy, just like everybody else. And you're going to be sleeping in a nice warm cot and 3 hots a day. So he takes me down to the Navy recruiter. Well, they noticed that I was a welder and a mechanic. So they said, we had just the thing for you, the United States Navy Seabees. I said, what's that? And he said, it's a Navy unit. So I said, well, I'm not going to Vietnam. And he goes, no. He said, you're going to be going to Hawaii, and you'll be sitting on the beach drinking a drink with a little umbrella in it. And I said, sign me up. And he signed me up. 6 months later, I was in Da Nang going, how in the world did I get here? And if I ever go back there and see this recruiter, I'm going to whoop his butt. But I end up spending the next 3 tours in Vietnam. I was all over the Philippines, Okinawa, Hawaii, Alaska. So I joined. That was in August of '66 when I went in. I got my discharge in 1972.
How did I get into the Navy? Like I mentioned before, the Navy recruiter was next door to my dad's service station. My uncle in World War II, his little brother, in the Battle of the Coral Sea, he was killed. I was named after my Uncle Jimmy. I tell Jesse the story that three times he was captured by the Germans and three times he escaped. But I remember the stories he used to tell me about the Army, and I says, well, if it's meant to be, it's meant to be. I might be on a ship, but I'm going down with the Navy. And my dad was in the Navy. Mm-hmm. So we got to cross paths, and that's one of the things that we have in common. His dad was, Jesse's dad was on a PT boat.
PT boat, yeah.
And my first assignment was on the USS Hornet, CVS 12. Mm-hmm. My great niece got me that hat. I went to electronic school first. I didn't really care for that, so I told them for Christmas I want to go home and send me out in the fleet. So they put me on this carrier, and right away I had skills like typing and good memory and that sort of thing. My memory's gone now. But anyway, I became a captain's yeoman, and I was on there for 2.5 years. After that, 2 years, and I sure enjoyed carrier life. I had no idea what it'd be out there in the jungle fighting and being on a minesweeper. My battle station was Twin 50s because they saw where I could shoot, and I could hit barrels out at sea going up and down bobbing. So they says, you're going to be the mount captain on the M20, but then they saw there was no need for that, so they put me on standby on the Twin 50s, and I never left that battle station. Boot camp, I had a choice of going to San Diego or going to Great Lakes, Illinois, and I thought, I've never been out away from Las Cruces, so I am going to see the country. They put me on a train, and here I went to Great Lakes, Illinois. It was in the summer. It was kind of humid. But I did enjoy boot camp, made a lot of friends, some of which have passed away already. George Kefalotis, I don't think I've ever mentioned it to Jesse, or maybe he's heard the name. He was from Chicago, Greek. And I met his folks. But we became good friends. He was killed, that was a sad moment. You hate to lose a shipmate. Yeah. I'll talk a little bit more about the minesweeper in a little bit, and I'm going to let Jesse tell us what he did. And talk to each other. Yeah, go ahead, Jesse. Tell us. I like your stories about you being in Da Nang and Monkey Mountain and running over the wires.
Well, Jimmy was a blue water sailor. I was a Navy Seabee, and we call ourselves mud sailors because we're always in the dirt. My first tour in Da Nang was... Well, it was my first time getting shot at. And I have a good friend of mine. He's recently passed away. We were in a firefight in Da Nang at our fire base. And he kept wanting to jump up. And I kept pushing him down. He'd jump up and push him down. But you could hear the rounds going right over the top of our heads. And you could see the tracers. So afterwards... he looked at me the next when the sun came up, and he was laying back in the hole, his eyes all bugged out, and he goes, "I think they're trying to kill us." I said, "Yeah, I think that's the idea. We're on the other side, you know." My boot camp was a lot different. We were Seabees, so they sent me to Quonset Point, Rhode Island, better known as Davisville. And I thought I'd go to Great Lakes, but no. They always send you a thousand miles away from where you live.
That's a fact.
And since I lived in Chicago, and Great Lakes was only like 30 miles from me, you go, nah, we'll send him to the Davisville, Rhode Island. And when I got there, I met another guy, another CB, and we were both from Chicago. And his name was Anthony Grosso. And Anthony Grosso and I became the best of friends, a little Italian kid from the west side of Chicago. And so we hung out together. We did everything. But he would get us in more trouble. I've never met a guy to get you in that much trouble.
That's awesome.
He was really good at mimicking joke records. So when they turned out the lights at night, we'd all go to sleep. And he would sit up there and just start telling jokes. And the whole barracks would go up in laughter. And the next thing you know, we're out running around with a rifle over our head. And the DI is screaming at us. And so the next time I was on fire watch. So he gets up and comes in there and goes, oh, you're on watch? I said, yeah. He said, let's go shoot some pool. I said, they put the pool cues up at night. You can't go in there. He says, no. And he goes over and picks up a push broom, unscrews the handle out. And here we are at 2 o'clock in the morning shooting pool. And he said, but you got to be quiet. we promised each other if we went to Vietnam that we would have each other's back. And unfortunately, in August of 67, he was killed in Dong Ha. And I happened to fly into Dong Ha on my second tour, and I decided I would look for him because I knew MCB 11 was there. So I'm walking around looking for him, and I happened to see another friend of ours that was in boot camp with us. And he was walking up the road, and I stopped him, and he had that 1,000-yard stare. And he was staring at me. I said, where is he? Where's Anthony? Or as we called him, Tony. Where is Tony? He said, he's dead. And
that's
I said, what?
That's a sad moment.
And he walked away, and he didn't turn back and didn't say anything, but never looked back at me. Wow. And I was hurt. And I was walking down the road, and they told us, get on this 6x, you're going south. So they took us to Quang Tree. And for all those years, that was in 1967, I had felt that I had let him down, that I should have been there when he got hit. Of course, I'd probably been dead too, but that's not the point. The point was we promised that we would protect each other. And the strangest thing, I'll tell you how funny life is, I moved to Las Cruces, New Mexico, in 1995, and my son, who had retired from the Army, told me, he said, you need to go and check in to a PTSD group. And I told him, ain't nothing wrong with me. He said, Dad, we grew up with you. We know you got a problem. So I went down there, and I joined up, and there was a CB in there sitting right next to me. And I was talking to him. I said, I had a good friend of mine, Anthony Grosso. He said, I knew him. He said, well, I remember with him when he got hit. In fact, I'm the one that carried him into sick bay. And I said, was he crying or was he whining? He said, no, he was barking out orders and telling people stuff. And we're going to make this. And he was talking to the other guy that got hit. But both of them succumbed to their wounds and died. But just the fact that I met this friend of mine in Las Cruces that was there when he got hit, and it told me exactly what happened. After years of alcohol and drinking and doing a little everything, trying not to remember him, that took the hurt away.
I have a friend that he was a lot younger than I was, but he liked to hang around with me. I had a 52 Cadillac limousine. And his dad owned American Linen. And so he'd come by the station And my dad would help us polish that car. So he was 19 years old. He joined up with the Marines. And I knew he had joined the Marines because I went to his going away party. And I always wondered, of course, here in Las Cruces, we have Andy Cabrera that got hit, Chavez that never came back. But this friend of Joe's and mine, and my mind went blank. It goes blank and then it comes back. So I'll bring the name back. Mike Lutz and him were and his dad were partners at This American Linen. But anyway, I was talking to Joe Gomez one time, and I says, "Do you know whatever happened to?" And he says, "Yeah, I saw him get killed in Vietnam," and he was a local guy. Can you imagine? I had the name before we started the conversation. Now it's gone, and that's the way it works with me.
We're getting there.
It used to be, and I told them 20 years ago that my mind was going, and they says I know it does go. And I didn't want to continue on as commander there at the VFW, but they said, nobody else can do it, and you've got so much practice that you continue. Anyway, you talk about a small world, and, you run across people in places like Kaohsiung, China, a David Cordero. I remember him. He was on a repair ship, and I was on that minesweeper. And we pulled in. We lost a screw, and they fixed it for us. And Ernest Rivera, I ran across him in Alangapo there in the Philippines. In the Philippines, we'd always run across somebody. We'd go to a different little nightclub, and there'd be somebody there from back home, Mesilla, Anthony, or whatever. But one of the big things that I remember. About being starting out in that minesweeper, right out of Guam, we hit a typhoon it was a typhoon of all typhoons.
That's the reason I was a dirt sailor.
Yeah.
I don't need to be out in the middle of the water.
And I tell you, we hit some stuff that's out there floating in the ocean, and we almost went down on that minesweeper. But we were able to, that's our job, keep that ship afloat. Wood, minesweepers are made out of wood because if they detect metal or magnets and mines hit them because of the metal hulls, they'll go up. So we were a wooden ship. Tell me about your experiences with the actual repairs of where you told me you'd pick up all kinds of army or whatever.
Well, it's called DC-8s. It's called Comshaw.
Comshaw, that's what.
If we needed a part, and if it was sitting there, we stole it. Comshawed it. Sorry,
borrowed it.
Yeah, borrowed it. So, we had an incident where I'd gotten in some trouble in California, and my company commander came down at 2 o'clock in the morning and got me out of jail. And so he decided that I owed him. So anyway, we got to Okinawa, and he got drunk at the Air Force Base, Kadena, and he comes down and back to the base, and he runs off the road and hits a tree. And then so he comes to my rack and wakes me up and goes, "You know you owe me, right?" I said, "Yes, sir." He said, "My Jeep is in a tree, and I need you to go down there and get it and bring it back and fix it." So we get up and get a wrecker, and we go down there. And sure enough, there's a hole going through off the road. And sure enough, it was there in a tree, up in the tree. It didn't hit the tree. It was up in a tree.
Literally.
Yeah, because it went off the road and flew and fell in a tree. So we had to unhook it and pull it down and got it down. And it was kind of, it was beat up. So we got it back to the base and we looked at it and said, this thing's unrepairable. And I said, well, let me think a minute. You know, the Air Force has got a lot of Jeeps and all we need is a front end off a Jeep and the radiator and everything. He says, yeah, well, how are you going to get it? I said, don't worry about it. We'll take the wrecker. I'll make out a chit that says that we're here to pick up a Jeep. And we drove down there and picked up the Jeep. It's 2 o'clock in the morning, probably 3 o'clock by then. And the guard is about half asleep anyway. So we go in there with a wrecker and he just waves us in. So we go down there and pick up this Jeep, take it back, and took the front end off of it, took the radiator, took everything off of it, put it on the lieutenant's Jeep. And then we were looking at it, except Air Force is a blue. And ours, of course, is OD. And he goes, that's not going to work. I said, well, we're going to have to paint it.
We're going to make it work.
Yeah, so we painted it and put FSN numbers on it. And all CBs have a big yellow B on it. So we
put a B
took
on
a
that.
Rattle can and put the B on it. So next morning, we take it down there and put it in his spot because he has an inspection that morning. And so we saw him walking up the road. And he just like, oh, yeah, so you got my Jeep done. I said, yeah. I said, but don't touch the paint. It's still wet. He says, oh, I understand. But
that's a good answer. Yeah.
He became my best friend, and I would follow him anywhere. And then he decided that we were going back. He was a Mustanger, came up from E1 to a lieutenant, and he just wanted to be in Vietnam. Yeah. So he decided we're going back. And the first person's name he put on the list was mine.
Edison, what was the name?
Yeah. And so I ended up going back. That was my second tour. Yeah. And we ended up back in October of 67. We landed in Dong Ha, went to Quang Tri. And while we were there, we built a 4,000-foot airstrip. We built the hangars for the 3rd Marine Air Wing. And then, of course, and that was in 68, January 68, we finished. And that was when Tet Offensive started.
Yep.
And we got hit all night long, every night.
We were on the river.
It was crazy. I mean, one night I remember very vividly, we had a fog come in and they couldn't get planes up and we were getting hit. We were figuring we were going to get overrun. And so we were on the radio talking back and forth and they said, no, we can't get up. We can't get anything up. It's too foggy. So this all of a sudden the radio breaks in and it's the USS New Jersey and it's sitting there and he goes, exactly what's your coordinates? And we had an Air Force guy there he gave coordinates. And so he gave it to the Navy. And they said, okay, put your head down. We're going to fire for effect. And when these 18-inch guns, man, they put out something as big as a Volkswagen. And it came flying through the air, and you could see the—
You could hear it.
Oh, you could hear it. It was like a jet plane coming in. And when it was so foggy— And when it went through the fog, you could see that it looked like hair around the shell. And when it landed, I was laying on the ground. And when it landed, the ground came up and hit me in the face. And the guy says, they changed the coordinates a little bit. And he says, okay, incoming. And man, they must have shot about 20 rounds in there. I mean, just they must have all broadside that thing. Man, oh man, the ground was shaking. It had holes out there. Big enough you could put a 6x truck in it. But the VC backed off.
I was alongside the New Jersey. Our condensers went out, so we were taking in water. And, the 5-inch guns went off, and that shook our little minesweeper. And they says, wait, when you pull off, the 16s are going to go off. And when they went off, our— We were rocking and rolling. Golly, I couldn't believe that. You know, one of the things you mentioned. Oh, I thought of my best friend's name, John Reisner. And Mike Lutz and him worked together. Their dads owned the American Linen. And Mike Lutz was in our class of 62. We graduated together. Mm-hmm. He went on to train dogs there in Riverside, California. And, of course, there was, I'd say about 10 of the class of 62 that went into the service. One came out a colonel, Bobby Yarian. Gates, he was a helicopter pilot. But some of the ones that didn't come back, Chavez and, of course, John Reisner. You look around Las Cruces and you think of where we used to run around. We'd drag the Shamrock, which was a soda drive-in type thing, and then we'd go see the Roadrunner there at the Fiesta Drive-In or the Rocket. That was one of the things. We'd go to the show just to see the Roadrunner. But the things that the military does for us, and I encourage young folks, put in 2 years at least. It's kind of like the Peace Corps. Get the experience. You meet a lot of friends. And, of course, you, like Jesse says, you hang around with people. They become your best friends, and you tell each other, I've got your back. That's of course, right. They separate you. And
I went in 1966, and the friends that I met then are still my friends today.
Absolutely.
55 years later.
Yeah.
And we consider each other brothers. Mm-hmm. And even though we don't discuss that much, but when we discuss politics,
yeah,
we go back and forth. But what we do is we respect the fact that you have your leanings and he has his, and you respect both of them. So as military people, that's what we do.
We don't talk about politics. We bring it up now and then, but no. We are here to keep this country what it is. We muddle through, like the Revolutionary War, Civil War. We muddle through World War I, too. But we come back, and people will ask me, how come you're still in the VFW? I tell them, the world's greatest country. I wouldn't trade it for anything. I am 51 years in the American Legion. I am the oldest continuous member of Post 10 here in Las Cruces, and I've been in the VFW 40-some-odd years. The Vietnam veterans, if there's a veterans organization I can help, I will help them. And I had a girlfriend tell me, you're married to the VFW. And I says, yep, I hope the VFW never divorces me. I might be separated for a little bit, but I'll come back. Veterans, to me, that's what keeps this country going. And Jesse and I, of course, we're on the same wavelength politically.
If you walk into the VFW, no matter what branch you're in, you're still our brother.
That's right.
And we welcome you with open arms, and then we buy you a beer.
That's right. You know, you ask about transition from the military to civilian life. I joined in 65, and I got out in 69. But I continued the Navy Reserve. I was in the Naval Reserve for 11 years, and then my brother switched me over to the Army Reserve. And I finished up there, so I'm retired reservist, and in 91 they gave us full medical. So there's some benefits that went along with it. I didn't expect them, but this country sees how we need to help veterans, and they do, and they have. They're a little behind. They don't always do what you think they're going to do, but. when you have 21 million veterans, it's hard to keep up. And in the military, will tell you, we're going to do the best we can to help you adjust to civilian life. Jesse, when he goes to the VA, and he told you a little bit about his PTSD class, he's got shrapnel still in his body, and they try to get it out, and it comes back. They find it someplace else. It's funny how that works.
Yeah, it's there are people that for years I would not go into the VA hospital because most vets will tell you that they respect the person that has lost a leg or that lost several extremities, and that's the people that you want them to take care of. You know, my little things that I have, little pieces of metal here and there, or the shrapnel in my eye and things like that, I didn't feel that it was justifiable for me to go in there and take somebody's place that had a leg blown off or arm blown off. So that was, and I never put in for a Purple Heart for the shrapnel that I got, because the guy that got hit with me almost blew his leg off. Yeah. And I thought, well, why would I get a Purple Heart for this couple of pieces of metal sticking me, yeah, and this guy got his leg blown off?
I have that documented. I got hit in the back, and I never thought of it as a cold round. And the corpsman just looked at it, patched it up, and I went on my way. But then one day, Billy Joe Bob noticed a big old bump on my back. Well, it was a piece of shrapnel. They cut it out, and everything's okay. I can't lift my arm too high, and my shoulders hurt. My arm on my hand on that side, I can't really manipulate it, but I'm okay. And I never put it. Yeah. In fact, they suggested a Purple Heart, but I said, not for that little thing. Let somebody else that really, like you say, I mean, Joe Gomez, poor guy, he's got a Purple Heart. Mike Burleson, Mike Calzada Sr. had 2 Silver Stars, and the stuff he went through, poor guy, I mean, you think about it, and, well, you know, we went through some stuff, but you think about them because you don't really think you went through anything. You didn't really get hurt. But, like, I think of my uncle. He was wounded, I don't know how many times, and 3 times he escaped from German prisons. His buddy was only able to escape twice. And he came back, he weighed 120 when he went into prison, and he came back at 95 pounds, I think he said. Ricky Lopez met him. Ricky's gone by Agent Orange. It's something that's still out there and causes cancer and diabetes, and we're still dealing with that. But hopefully the good Lord will find a little cure for us, and we'll be on our way. We have Vietnam veterans that are up in age, but then there's some that pass away at age 50, 60, now that the Korean War veterans are almost gone. It's the Vietnams that, and they've been hit hard. But World War II, I think we have one left there at the post. But we can all honestly say we wouldn't trade it for anything. We served our country. And these young ROTC guys that are willing to give up their young lives to be in the military, I take my hat off to them. Because I'm going to be honest with you, it's a volunteer service now, and we got drafted, put in our 2 years, and we were out. These poor guys, they're serving 4 or 5 tours, and they come back, like Jesse says, without limbs, PTSD, I mean, there's another word for that one. I mean, completely out of your mind probably, but yeah, no. Well, if it wasn't, like I said earlier, one for the military and the veterans, this great country of ours would not exist. And that's my story, and I'm sticking to it. Let's see. You want to know a little bit about what happened after I got discharged? Well, you know what? I thought I'm gonna run to. I'm gonna work with my dad. He had two wreckers. 2 weeks before I got out of the Navy, he sold them. And I says, "What happened?" And he says, "Oh no, it's too much work. You don't need to work." Well, the military had a program, career opportunities. And they teach you how to become teachers. So I became a teacher. I was a teacher for 7 years. And that's what I did. And then I went into insurance. But God's been good to me, better than I deserve. And I'm glad to give you this little interview. Jesse, wrap it up for us.
Well, when I got out, as being a construction mechanic in the Seabees, I went back into it. Became a welder, and I took the test and became a master mechanic, and I retired as a master mechanic. And then I decided I'm still too young to sit down, so I started a barbecue business. And I bought a barbecue trailer because my father was a chef cook on a railroad, so my last retirement was a barbecue trailer. And I belong to the Kansas City Barbecue Association, and we were one of the best barbecue places in Las Cruces.
Still is.
Yeah, still people still follow me around, asking me if I'm going to open again.
And he'll do a little cooking for us there at the post, ribs. His barbecue sauce you cannot beat. And, of course, his ribs, everybody is waiting for a rib to, yeah, no, yeah, delicious. Jesse, it's still the best barbecue.
Yeah, we just cooked for the honor flights and from here, and we cooked,
I bought 150 pounds of brisket.
Brisket, and
it all went.
120 jalapeno hot links, and we had it was chicken. We had chicken too,
and we had chicken,
yeah, whole chickens, and we thought we had enough meat that would last at least 2 hours. It lasted about 45 minutes.
It was gone. Yeah, I did get a barbecue sandwich. Yeah. Well, we'll just wrap it up by saying to you, thank you for thinking of the veterans and getting their stories, because I tell you what, American citizens, the youth, they need to hear about what went on in Vietnam. And I've got more stories going up and down the rivers, close to Cambodia. They don't let you do certain things, but
did them anyway.
We did them anyway. That's right. And again, thank you for your organization. And I hope to be there in Washington, D.C. at the archives and go through your through all your commentaries and veteran stories. Thank you.
Thank you.